Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Mark Rucker, theater director, who is currently directing a production of Once in a Lifetime at the Oslo Repertory Theater. This is the first of a series of interviews I'm doing with directors who are directing for the Oslo in this season. This is the beginning of what I think of as kind of a crash course in directing. In addition to that interesting information, you will learn about Mark and how he discovered that he was a director in the third grade. Stay tuned. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Is all about you and me and everyone we know, because I believe, based on my many years as a psychotherapist and my more than that years of being a human being observing other human beings, that we all learn somehow to hide aspects of ourselves, pieces of ourselves, in our childhood. This is not rocket science. If you observe any family, you can see parents letting children know in no uncertain terms that that behavior, that thought, that way of being, that natural skill or ability is unacceptable. Do not do that. Do not be that, more to the point. And because children are nothing if not flexible, and there is no greater need that children have than pleasing the parent, we all learn to put some of who we are aside. And we get so good at it that we forget that we did it, so we come into adulthood without access to some qualities which we may need. Parents who are made uncomfortable with outbursts of anger can successfully convince a child that they do not get angry. And while anger is not perhaps the most attractive thing that human beings can do, really, you can't get through life successfully without knowing when you have been made angry, and sometimes letting other people know that that behavior that they exhibited or did with you made you angry. So it would be useful to people who have managed to think of themselves as never able to be angry to recover that capacity. And that's what this show is about. The recognition that you may have hidden something even from yourself, the recognition that that is not gone forever and that you can get it back. That is, of course, the work I do as a psychotherapist. Much of the work I do is simply about helping people figure out what it is they have hidden and how to get it back, how to get access to it. And I do that currently on the telephone exclusively with clients all over the world. So if you're interested in that, you can go up on my website and email me and tell me that you'd like to talk to me. And you would be one of the 65,000 people who have listened to the show in the last year. And again, if you are one of those people, please email me and tell me where you are, who you are perhaps, and where you're listening from. Okay, enough about that. I don't have very much time today because the interview I'm doing with Mark Rucker takes up most of the hour, and it's worth it. Mark is very, very interesting, and as you heard, if you were listening to the lead-in, Mark is a theater director who is currently directing Once in a Lifetime, an absolutely hilarious play and production at the Oslo Repertory Theater Company in Sarasota, Florida. So I'm not going to say very much more because, as I said, the interview is long and I want you to hear all of it. So here, in his own words, Mark Rucker. Okay, I am here in the Oslo Mezzanine with Mark Rucker, and he is the director of Once in a Lifetime, which is opening at the Oslo on the 6th.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, very close. Oh, my God.
A week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow.
Amazing.
And I can't believe you've taken this time out to meet with me. Great. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Okay, I do an internet radio show.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Ah.
I am looking at one such, am I not?
I am. You are. I am too.
Yes, good, good. And I always ask the same question.
Sure.
How did it happen? Not how did you become a director, although at some point I'd like to know that, but when was the very first moment in life, even if it was in the womb, when you thought, theater, story, telling people what to do, I don't know.
Yeah. No, for me, it was when I was, I think I was in the third grade, and we were doing a Christmas show, mm-hmm. and I was put together with a group of people, and we were meant to do a recitation or a version of the Night Before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it was very chaotic. And I just naturally sort of took charge and sort of made it happen. And that was when I first thought, oh, this is interesting, this is fun. Everybody was really appreciative of it.
You know, it's funny. When I said, story theater or telling people what to do,
yeah. You
know, I've never said that to another soul.
Well,
clearly
it's part of what I do.
That is right. I know.
I am the middle child. Everybody has different theories, but yeah. It makes me uniquely qualified to be a director.
Tell me.
Because when I say it's telling people what to do, it actually isn't always telling people what to do. It's knowing how to manage personalities.
Yes.
Knowing how to make something go forward positively. I think because being a middle child, I was the kid that was sort of the cheerleader and the negotiator in my family.
Yes.
And so I was, and I was the planner. I think that a middle child doesn't have the spotlight,
yes.
And so either you figure out a subterranean way of getting what you need, and I just I felt like I was, because my brother does have a big personality, and my sister was the baby, and she was the only girl, and so I was the sort of in between, and I was the bookish one. Mm-hmm. I was named the good student, even though I wasn't the great. I was a good student, but I was sort of a brainiac, which is another way of sort of giving me
getting attention,
getting me a title.
Yeah, giving you a place.
Yeah.
Right, giving you a place. No,
so,
I think you're right.
And then I just naturally did like to figure things out and plan things. And so, like family vacations, I would scour over the AAA books and figure out which hotels we would stay in. And when I was 18, I planned a trip to Europe. I mean, obviously my parents helped, but
yeah,
I did
a lot of the
research and a lot of the...
Right.
So I just sort of like naturally took to that kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, no, it's clear that, I mean, so in the third grade, you're what, 8, 10?
Yeah.
Like that,
something
right?
Something like that.
Right. And so you have this experience, which is not unlike the experience you're having at home, which is that you can influence, you can design,
yeah.
you can,
yeah.
you know, right?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
And you find a place... outside of home,
right.
where it's of value,
yeah.
you know, where
yeah.
you can do it spontaneously and people appreciate it, as
right.
you say.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
So did it occur to you then that this was a life, a work?
No, it didn't occur to me until high school. And I was very lucky because I grew up in Southern California in the late 70s, where there was a really strong school system, which doesn't exist at all.
Yeah. Right.
My high school, my public high school, had a really big theater program, and we did a lot of plays. And so while I was in school, I was able to be in plays, but also to learn about production and tech things. And then I was given opportunities to direct. So that
in high school.
So I think my second year in high school, I directed a small one-act play.
Wow.
And then I directed some more with a friend. And then by the time I was a junior and senior, I was directing full productions. That were in our school program, and some that I, with my own motivation, went to another program in my high school and got the support, you know, sort of student body support to pay for plays.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that again, that's that other skill. The I create things, I make things happen, I plan things.
Yeah.
I, you know.
So that's when I thought this is what I want to do, and then when I went to college, I went to UCLA, and I was very, very fortunate to go there at a time when there just happened to be a new professor who was interested in teaching directing in a more elaborate way than what had been offered there. So I was part of a class of 6 directors that went for the entire year, did this very, very intense training of all aspects of directing, very, very technical stuff. And
can you give us a little example of what that means, very technical stuff?
Yeah, we'd spend a week. Well, first, you learned how to break down a play, break down a scene. So acting scenes can be broken down, if you choose to do it this way, into beats and little sections of. So if there's a scene that you and I are having,
right,
and it's going along nicely, and then something you say offends me,
yes,
that's a beat shift. It means I went from this being relaxed with you to being tense with you. And that means the scene's going to change between you and I, because you're either going to do something with my tenseness or ignore it, which is going to do something
else.
And
right.
so plays can be broken down into all those things, particularly when you're talking about realistic plays, naturalistic plays. It's about human behavior,
yes,
and negotiating that.
And essentially,
so we would spend weeks learning how to do that and labeling the beats of each scene, and then we would spend another week on more technical things like focus. So we would sit in a studio and we would have actors or each other, and we would create a scenario, which is like you and I like this,
mm-hmm,
kind of leaning into each
yes.
other. Then we would talk about what does that look like, what is that saying to the audience, or if I'm like this,
right,
looking at you, that's another thing. It's
yeah,
very technical
Mark
stuff.
Is,
I'm holding
aside,
my arms,
right, right.
And I'm looking slightly askance at you.
That's right, that's right.
And that's not anything to do with acting, necessarily. It's stage pictures. And so we learned how to tell the audience, give the audience information through all those things. Or levels. I'm now getting up on my chair looking down at you.
Yes.
That gives me power over
yes.
you. So it's really fun technical stuff that I still use to this day.
Yes, but wait. You said this is not acting, but this is stuff that you can give to an actor.
I could give to an actor, and an actor, if I just asked the actor to stand on the chair and look down at you, the actor would immediately start to feel something, even if they don't have
yes.
material.
Yes.
And so it just gives them a clue as to how they should behave, and they usually just, then they take it, and they fill in the acting part. And all of it should come from the material, the play that you're working on.
All the beats.
Yeah.
It should all come from the play.
Yeah, everything comes from the play.
Right.
So these are all tools.
Yes.
Any kind of technique, acting technique or directing technique, they're all, for me, I use them when I have a problem. I don't take the actors and break down the play. Some actors do.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, some directors do. Yeah. They will break down a play. I'll talk about a play that includes talking about the beats, but I don't necessarily name it that way.
Unless it looks like it's
needed. There's a problem and we can't figure it out, and then I will ask a question that is about
what's going on here. Yeah.
And we solve it together because actors and directors are all trained in different ways, but we end up doing the same thing, and so you have your way of acting, I have my way of acting. Hopefully we can work together well. If not, we've got a problem, and the director's got to help figure it out so that you look like you're on the same page.
Oh, when you said you have a way of acting and I have a way of acting, you meant the two actors.
The two actors in
right,
the play.
Right.
If they were trained differently, they might use different ways of talking about beats when I trained in acting, we had something called a play need. What's your overall arching need your character has? Mm-hmm. And it might be to hang on to your self-respect. Everything was about self-respect. It's about how people saw you. It's how you perceive, and so you behave accordingly.
Right.
Or if it's about proving that I'm a real man. My manhood is the most important thing to me. Everything I do to you ultimately fulfills the idea that my manhood stays intact.
Right.
So, but another actor might not have play needs, scene needs, beats.
Right. They may have an entirely
different
way.
Strategy
right.
for doing that.
Right.
But we can talk about human behavior and figure out how we can.
Because everybody has that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, it's always interesting to me.
Yeah.
You know, to hear specifically, technically, how a person is looking at their work and what they know that I don't know about
mm-hmm.
about their work.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So you were lucky enough to get this year of, you know,
training.
Immersion
yeah.
in the various, well, I imagine the techniques, whatever the professor
right.
brought to,
yeah.
to bear.
Yeah.
So you had a repertoire, you had a toolbox.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. And that included not only how to work with actors, but it included how to work with designers and playwrights.
Really?
Yeah. So when you're working with a playwright on a new play, you're collaborating with them. You're helping them to fulfill their vision for a play that they've written.
Right.
And when you are working with a designer, you know, when I trained again in the 80s, there was a lot. We trained a lot in realistic plays, and also we understood that if we were going to go out into the world, that we were going to be working in modified theaters, meaning other than just a proscenium traditional theater, because usually smaller theaters that would hire younger directors
right.
would be three-quarter thrust or in the round or some modified version of that, not with a curtain and a proscenium. So we learned a lot about how to stage in the thrust and in the round. We learned about how to create a ground plan for a play, which is where all the furniture is placed and how it could best serve the idea, particularly, say, in the round, where you need the actors to move around a lot so that the audience feels equally taken
right.
care of.
Yeah, right.
Feeling like I'm in a bad seat.
Yes.
So we a lot of that stuff was great, great groundwork.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, really, so was this your first year, your last year?
This was my sophomore year of undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And then so my junior year of undergraduate, they had a couple of programs at UCLA where you could direct one-act plays. And so I quickly did those in my junior year, and I got to my senior year, and I didn't have anything to do because normally you would, I don't know, it's just, we because of this intensive training, we were sort of a year ahead.
I was going to say, right.
And so we found, again, ways to direct other places at UCLA that outside of the theater department that would let us direct plays.
You and your group.
A couple of the other directors.
Right. Yeah. So you directed all the way through college?
Yeah.
And always a realistic plays? Or?
No, let's see. New plays, and fairly realistic plays, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are they your favorite, or...?
I am very lucky in that I started after undergraduate doing a lot of Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
And that's partly
and
because
how and
it started in California. Someone that I knew was involved with a Shakespeare festival in Santa Cruz, which is in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And so it was the beginning of a wonderful festival there. And I started working there. And basically my first professional job was at Shakespeare Santa Cruz in Northern California, which shortly after became Michael Edwards, who's the artistic director here, brought me to Santa Cruz. So he was a graduate student at UCLA when I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And so we started a company of actors and directors from UCLA after school, and we got together and did studying, and Michael actually led this company. He was teaching classes mm-hmm. after he graduated. And then we started doing plays. And we
so
did
you,
plays
so you
in
were
LA.
Creating a company.
We created a company in LA, and then Michael got a job teaching at UC Santa Cruz. And so I kept the company in LA, and it morphed into a couple of other versions of itself. And then he asked me to come up and help him. I think I assisted him in Santa Cruz the first summer that he worked there. Under another artistic director, and then he had to do two plays the second year, and he needed an associate director, and then that's how I got my foot in the door.
And grew in it.
The woman that was running the theater liked me and hired me the third season to direct my own play.
So
and he took over that company, and I worked there with him, and then after he left, for a total of about 10 years.
Wow.
And so that's how I learned Shakespeare was doing it.
That was my question. Is it very different than what you learned? Are the beats the same? Human behavior is
yes,
the same?
Yes, it is, although sometimes it's poetry and it needs to be talked about in a different way. But human behavior is human behavior.
Right.
And while there is much more theatricality in it because it wasn't written as realism, it's not kitchen sink realism, the same behavior applies, the same emotional vividness is required for it. It has a different kind of like design and staging because there are a billion different ways to do Shakespeare. Again, in my book, you've got to let it come from the text. You've got to use the play. But unlike more contemporary writing, classical plays require, I think, even more choices from the director. You have to decide how you're going to enter into the world of that play. There are some people, although I think it's less and less, who used to believe that there was one way to do Shakespeare, which was this doublet and hose with a sort of faux Tudor-looking stage house kind of thing. And that's really, it's a very American thing. It was created after World War II when Shakespeare companies summer Shakespeare festivals were popping up all over the country. And these academics or whoever who started them felt like this is the way you do it. And you try to recreate Shakespeare's version,
right.
Which is impossible. Because everybody's standing and half of them are drunk and there's a bear baiting before. I mean, it's not
that's
real.
Right, that's right.
So if you really want to do it like Shakespeare.
Right. People are eating and the kids are crying.
It's totally different.
And,
you can't do it because people don't want that. But I came into the directing of Shakespeare when people thought there was just one way to do it. But I was lucky enough because there were people like Michael who were saying, well, that's not true.
Right.
There's all these different ways to do it, and it's how you respond to the play, and you can set it. And I have to say, like, when I started directing Shakespeare, we did, like, I'll set it in the 70s in a trailer park, or I'll, I'll set it in a tropical, like, a contemporary military version of Othello, you know, which has been done a million times. But I tend to think now you really shouldn't try to set Shakespeare in a literal world. It's much more expansive than that, and so if you try to connect that text to
something
a literal world, or even a decade, or a year, or a really specific city or nation, it's just not quite. It needs more room.
Well, it's timeless.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, trying to tie it to a time.
To tie it too much to a time. If you can be evocative of a time, mm-hmm. or evocative of an era without it landing too hard, then I think it's best.
Yeah.
But it took me a while to learn that because I was guilty of setting it in those kinds of places. And honestly, we wanted to turn the perception of how you do Shakespeare on its head because
we
were tired of seeing Doublet and Hose,
right.
And what we used to call Hey Nonny Nonny Shakespeare. And so now I actually, in a way, I get hungry for that kind of Shakespeare, which I'm glad. That's only healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I got very lucky because that's how I cut my teeth. If you can do Shakespeare, you can do almost anything. And I think it's interesting to me, like, musical theater directors are often very good at doing Shakespeare.
Because
they can understand the larger ideas. Mm-hmm. They can move greater groups of people around a stage. They can incorporate music and theatricality that musicals have that straight plays don't always have.
Yeah.
So that's, and then I'm fortunate that after I started working in regional theater, I worked at several theaters, one in particular, that did a lot of new work. And so I got to develop plays and do first productions of plays.
Those authors were very lucky to have you, as you are so dedicated to the text.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they like that.
I'm sure they did.
But also not just the text, but their visions, but particularly when they're actually sitting in the room, mm-hmm. and explaining themselves. And so I got to do a lot of that. So I feel really fortunate that I've got to do a lot of classical work and a lot of new play development.
Yeah, you're on both ends of the continuum, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really, it's nice. And it's lovely to go from one to the other.
Okay, so what about the...
So I'm working on this old play
now. Yes, right.
And then when I get back to San Francisco, I start working on a brand new play.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
So that's exciting.
Yeah, so it's great. You're not in danger of being bored.
No.
Okay, so talk to me about this old play and why it attracted you and...
I have loved this play since I was a teenager. As you can already tell, I was a theater nerd,
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid and all the way through high school. I was
How
in
did
drama
you discover
club.
This?
I just started doing. I think I had my first acting class in junior high school, and it was a very sort of improv kind of theater game kind of class, and I really loved it. And so when I got to high school, I just immediately took an acting class and auditioned for the plays. And did the props and got very involved and found a community,
mm-hmm.
that I really liked.
Yeah.
Even though it was considered particularly nerdy in Newport Beach, California, to be in the drama club. But I thrived there. And
I'm just curious, how did your family, did they care? Did they like it?
My family was incredibly supportive. My brother had done some theater when he was in high school, and then my sister after me got very involved, and she took dance, and it wasn't like we were forced to do it in any way. My parents were very much like, what are you into? Go for it. But they were incredibly supportive. The first play that I worked on in high school was The Miracle Worker. Do you know that play about Helen Keller?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get cast in it, but I was the prop designer for it, which I took very, very seriously. And so my mother came to see the show, and what she didn't know when she let me do this, and I can't believe she let me use our home antique dining room set. for the production.
Oh my God.
And so she let me schlep it to the theater, use it for a week and a half or ever, and then bring it home, which is incredible. But she was horrified because if you remember The Miracle Worker, there's a very violent breakfast scene between Annie Sullivan and Helen Keller where she's forcing her to learn language. And my mom watched her antique dining room set get sort of thrown around the stage and the chairs and everything. She was horrified. But, so that they were pretty supportive.
So it's one thing to be supporting your kids who are playing with this in school. It's quite another when they say, this is the life I want to live. They were fine about that as well.
Well, you know, I was so involved in it, I don't think there was ever a question. My parents, my father had a very artistic sort of part of himself. Mm-hmm. He painted at times and even won an award, I think, in high school for flower arranging and stuff. It was so funny for this barber to do that. But he always had an appreciation of art and encouraged me. And my mother was in her own way an artist in that she was my entire life she spent decorating rooms in our homes. Mm-hmm. So that she still does it, mm-hmm. Where she would decorate a room and then she'd go on to the next room and then she would be finished and she'd kind of start over again. So growing up I had like a race car room, an astronaut room, a bicentennial bedroom, and
it's like plays going on.
Yeah, I had another set every couple of years.
Exactly.
So we had this massive living room wall. It was a great big sort of A-frame suburban home, and it had a massive wall that I think had about 30 different colors that she painted it. She would just say, no, it needs to be this color. So she was very creative in her own way.
Yes, exactly.
And that definitely inspired me.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
And they could be sympathetic to that.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. I never felt them question.
You do know that lots of
families.
So that's lovely. And
I taught a class actually a couple of years ago, and this girl, young woman, came in to my class for the interview. I had to choose the actors that would be in this class, and it was an undergraduate. And she said, "I don't know what's going to happen when my parents find out that I've taken this class.
Yeah,
they will really, really." They would never let me have permission to take this class if they knew about it.
Wow.
But I want to be an actress.
Yeah.
And my parents want me to be a lawyer.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, but my parents didn't.
Yeah, you were very lucky.
I was.
Yeah, you were very lucky.
And I'm really lucky too in that I've always been given permission to do this work. I mean, it's not easy to get this work.
And you're very lucky all around.
Incredibly lucky, and then mm-hmm. they just keep letting me do it. And I often wonder what if I had been, because a lot of people, particularly actors, who get tired of it.
Right.
You know, get the rejection. It's unbelievable. Being an actor is really hard because you get rejected most of the time. But you either learn how to survive that, and you learn to find where you are accepted and go in that direction. Or you become something else. And it's been very interesting for me to see the actors that I knew morph into a television producer, mm-hmm. or a lawyer, or a restaurant owner, mm-hmm. you know, or something like that. It's where you use all the skills that you learn doing theater to do something else and become a great success. And so I think I kind of, in a weird way, wished that I had been given a lot more no's to see where I might have gone. I'm sure I would have a lot more money, but I'm not sure that I would have the satisfaction and the, you know, the happiness that I get from doing this work.
No, and it seems to me that it's not just a no that makes people move on. People move on because it stops working for them.
Yeah.
And it hasn't stopped working for you.
No.
You know, so it might.
Yeah.
In the event that it does, you can ask that question again.
Well, you have different phases where you you know, it was really interesting for me. I started doing the directing, and there was a point at which I said, I have to quit my day job if I really want to be this in this vocation, and so I quit my day job, and I survived barely by doing assisting jobs and things like that, but they were in the theater.
Yes.
And I almost stopped because those, you know, making that little, I mean, it's really little money, and surviving that way was very hard for about a year and a half, and that's when I decided I had to go to grad school or to change things up, to sort of shake things up and see what the next thing was. And if I didn't get into grad school, I was going to have to pick a job.
Then you'd have to do something else.
And I think I actually decided I would go to travel agent school, which is hilarious because they don't really exist anymore. So
oh,
I don't know what would have happened to me.
It's very funny that directing turned out to be a more stable career.
Well, I think it's, again, from that childhood love of planning trips.
No, but I'm making a different point.
Oh, what?
That directing turned out to be a more stable career.
Oh, I know.
It's ridiculous.
No,
who
and in
thought?
Fact, there was a point... I was also incredibly lucky in that I got to direct a film.
Ooh.
At one point, about 10 years ago, and it was at probably the end of that era known as, you know, when American independent feature films were happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much harder now to make something like that happen, I was fortunate enough that my film was in competition at the Sundance Film Festival.
Wow.
Which is a big, big deal for
it's
a
huge.
Little movie and a huge thing for me. But and we won an award, and I couldn't be at the award ceremony because I had to leave the week before the festival finished to go direct a play to make my rent.
Wow.
And so the producer of the film had to say at the thing, it was like, it's ironic that he has to use theater to support his filmmaking career, because it's true, I didn't make a dime doing a film.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay, so now wait a second. Did we skip something? We had you at UCLA.
I left UCLA, started a theater group with some friends.
Yes, right.
We were very altruistic about the idea of starting a theater in Los Angeles, which is crazy.
Yeah, right.
And that lasted for about 4 years, and
that's when you weren't you were having work, and you were
for the last year and a half of that is when I decided I had to quit my day job and work. So I directed this theater group, but I also did these jobs to make money, and that's when I decided to go to grad school.
Right.
And so then. I got into graduate school at Yale, which is a great school to do that in, and it was a huge foot up for me to go there, and unfortunately, the name brand opportunities that gives you, but it also...
Unfortunately?
Well, I think, yes, in a way. I'm not necessarily proud to say just because you went to Yale, you get to go and meet these people that run these theaters.
Yes, well...
You know,
yeah.
Although I paid a lot of money for it,
I know.
And worked
and
really
hard,
yes.
Right? And you
yes.
got
but,
out, and
but
you did.
But it's just
right.
there are some people would say, "Oh, Yaleys, and they get everything," and so.
Only,
but I worked
only
out,
people
I worked really,
who didn't.
Yeah, but
right.
I worked really hard, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me because more than anything, I learned there. Because I said I learned a lot in undergraduate about directing. I gained confidence.
Yes.
Because when you get. When you go to a school that's prominent and you actually see you're actually functioning well and doing well and getting a lot of positive reaction to your work, it's like, oh, if I can do it here, I'm all right.
I'm all right.
And so, and it really did happen that because I went to school there, I got interviews at theaters. And I went back to California as opposed to going to New York, which a lot of my... fellow students, of course, almost everybody went to New York, except for some actors went to L.A. to pursue to television and film, but a theater director going to L.A., but it's because that was home.
Well, and there are a lot of theaters in L.A.
There are a lot of theaters. There's not a lot of paying theaters.
No, that's true.
But I managed to, you know, continue the whole time working my summers doing Shakespeare, and I started to work at other Shakespeare festivals, and just lucked into my first regional theater job. I think it's true, once you break into that, then other regional theaters see your name,
right.
They come see your work, and you start to get work.
It's like anything else. They have to know you.
Yeah, although I'm pretty sure that I got hired for a couple of jobs by artistic directors just through reputation. As I mentioned, I grew up in Orange County in Southern California, and one of the major regional theaters in the country is called South Coast Repertory Theater,
mm-hmm.
which is in Costa Mesa, which is Orange County. And because I grew up there, I grew up going to their shows, and I even volunteer ushered for them when I was in high school. When I finished graduate school, I sent them a note saying, I just got out of Yale, and I'm from Newport Beach, and I would love to come and meet you. And so the two artistic directors there met me, and they were sort of delighted because I was
hometown
kid,
right.
And I talked to them about the shows that I saw when I was a kid, and I'd gone to all the same public schools that one of them had gone to, so they felt an affinity. They never saw my work,
right?
And they had an emergency situation where a director had pulled out, and they said, let's give him a chance, and they gave me a chance, and
wow.
It worked out. And I worked there for 12 years. It became my sort of artistic home.
Wow.
And that's how it happens. It's so interesting, the
yes,
business,
it is.
Because it just takes a fluke, or you just have to be in the right place.
You have to
be
in the right place in the right time, and you can't create it. And there's the myth, you know, that if you do this or you do that or you work hard or you have, you know, that this is what's going to happen. But it's almost never that.
Yeah, I know. I do believe that if you work hard, though, you can get somewhere. But I think it's true. It's like
if you work hard and something like this happens to you, then the hard work shows and stands you in good stead. Right. You don't work hard and this happens to you, well, then you never get another job.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Right.
But the
right.
hard work itself?
No, I know a lot of people just trying.
And talent.
Yeah,
never mind.
I have friends who are incredibly talented, and they can be very aggressive about their career, and then somebody will say, that person keeps sending me those notes and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, so they haven't, you know, who
it
knows?
It works against them.
Yeah, but it may work for
somebody else, that's
and
right.
And it may work
that's
against
exactly
them in
right.
another way.
So, of course, the point we're making, I think, is that there is no route.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So don't look for one.
But I think it's also, you do need to listen to what's happening. In other words, like, I think that I knew that when I finished graduate school, I wanted to work in American theater. I wanted to work in regional theater. I didn't want to go to New York and work on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had something to contribute to these theaters where I could do plays that I loved, like Once in a Lifetime, that would make me happy and the audience.
Right.
I think there sometimes is a perception in regional theater that you get hired to do last year's hit on Broadway.
Mm.
And it's not that fun for a lot of directors to do last year's hit on Broadway in a theater. Of course, if you love the play, it is fun.
Right.
And hopefully that's what happens, and that's what, like, Michael is brilliant at getting people married to plays that they feel passionate about.
It's so clear.
And so I knew that I didn't want to do that, but I knew that I wanted to do plays that I loved, like from American theater, say, from the 20s and 30s and 40s, and do them in these theaters that sometimes the relationship between the theater and their audience can be hard. You do a play that the audience doesn't like, or if you cater all your plays to the lowest common denominator.
Right.
Again, another thing Michael is amazing at, because he pleases, seems to be able to please everybody.
Yeah.
And that's not easy to do, because sometimes you do a new play and no one wants to go to it because they don't know it. And they don't want to spend their money on something they don't know about or they haven't heard anything about. So it's a challenge.
So I wanted to stop you because you said you knew this play, and I don't think you ever told us exactly how you knew
it. So when I was a kid, when I was telling you I was a theater nerd, I was about to tell you
mm-hmm.
that I was, I became obsessed with the Algonquin Round Table.
Oh,
are you familiar with them?
Yes, of course.
So all those wits from the 20s in New York, and I just thought that was the coolest thing, and I loved reading about them, and Dorothy Parker
and
Alexander Wolcott, so I read about all of them, and George S. Kaufman was part of that group, and I think maybe later Moss Hart was as well, although I'm not sure, but I know that that led me to a book called Act One, which is Moss Hart's autobiography. It's one of the best theater books ever.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it, and in it, he talks in great detail about the creating Once in a Lifetime. And so I read Once in a Lifetime, and I fell in love with it. And so I'm, you know, what, like 12? I mean, really not, really young to be reading nerdy stuff like that. But so I always loved it. But at the same time, it's one of those plays that doesn't get done very often because it's huge.
Ah.
It has 5 sets.
Wow.
And it has about 60 characters.
You're kidding.
No, and so it was done with a cast of about 38, I think, originally on Broadway. But that's when you could do that on Broadway.
Right.
And so, and actors were cheap right. because they weren't paid when they rehearsed a play.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, isn't that wild? There was no union then.
Wow.
So before the union came, the producers would, this may be reckless, but this is my memory of it, of reading about it, is that they didn't get paid anything. They started getting paid when the audience came. So if the show had two performances, they got paid for two performances, even though they'd worked on it for a month and a half before that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I had no idea.
So it's really hard. Well, that's why the union came about. Nobody does these plays because they're so large, unless you can figure out a way to do them with fewer people.
Right.
And people are doing that now. But still, this one is even harder.
So how many people have you got?
I have 19 here. And so a lot of them are playing several different parts. That it wouldn't probably happen if there was another thing that I like to do, and that is occasionally I like to work with students. I love going to a university or mm-hmm. a training program and directing those students in a play. And when I do that, I usually get to have some input as to which play it is. So about 10 years ago, I think I was asked to come to USC in Southern California and work with the students on a play. And I said, could I do Once in a Lifetime? Mm-hmm. Because there you had 100 students trying out for the play. So I got to do it with, I don't remember how many it was, maybe like 45 actors. And then I started, when I worked on it then, I started working on an idea of using video to help tell the story of the play. And then 2 years ago, I got to do it again in the MFA program at ACT, which is where I work. I'm the Associate Artistic Director of ACT in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I asked if I could work on Once in a Lifetime with them. And that time, I had a class of actors, which was only 12 actors. And so the goal of that workshop production was to do it with no money. And it was really fun. And it was part of the design of the conceit of the show, mm-hmm. is that you knew that actor was running off stage, quickly changing, yes, and running back on stage as another character. And it was really fun for the actors to do that kind of character.
Yes,
so that kind of is the inspiration for this production. So even though I have more actors, because in that workshop it was kind of fun to see people coming in with a cocked wig and doing it, but right. this is a much more sophisticated idea of a production, but still using lots of quick changes, and there's a video aspect to the production, which is that in between, while they're changing the sets, I have these little interludes where I project video. The play is set on the New York premiere of The Jazz Singer, which was the first talkie film with Val Jolson.
Right.
So to start things off, I show a little tiny clip of that movie so you can remember what it was like, or if you didn't know, see what it's like to hear talking pictures. And then when we go, the second scene of the play is on a train, and while we're changing the first scene of the second scene, there's a little vignette of Bing Crosby getting on a train and going to Hollywood.
Oh.
And like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, we'll do some of the starlets in the studio have these sound tests that they do to see if they're qualified to be in talking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to make little sound tests and show them to help bridge another scene change. And then later in the play, they actually make a movie. And it's called Gingham and Orchids, and it's really bad. And so before the last scene of the play, I went out with the actors on Lido Beach, and we saw a little scene from Gingham and Orchids.
Oh,
and we're
great.
Putting it together. So it's fun. And then inside the play, there's also video that's happening behind the actors. So the first scene of the play takes place in a little hotel room in New York City. And there's a window, and through the window you see a little slightly moving skyline of New York. And then the second scene is on a train, and through the windows on the train you see the desert going by.
That's great.
And so it's fun. It's really
great.
Nice.
Yeah. It's great.
It's
I can't
exciting.
Wait. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, all right. In closing,
yes.
I always ask the same question.
Of course.
And that is, you have literally given a life to the theater and primarily to directing.
Yeah.
And so if there's anything that you would say about it, I know you've said quite a lot about it, but anything that comes to mind about what it's like to have spent an entire life so far, in this work.
It's, For me, it's been an incredible adventure. I've been unbelievably fortunate, as I've said to you. I feel really, really blessed. And at the same time, it's hard work. And I think that the part that I like the best about it is the giving part, the giving the plays to the audience. Recently, a couple of years ago, I did a children's show for the first time. And that, what I'm about to talk about, is about constantly shifting. But that I to watch the kids see that show for the first time was a very moving experience for me. And so I feel blessed by the giving. And also I feel very moved by the generations of people who work together in a theater, so that giving my experience to the actors or to my assistants or to people that I collaborate with, and watching them work together and tell their stories, and watching, particularly on this production, there are young actors who are students here, and then there's the company of actors that are much more experienced, and the way that they relate to each other. I watch the young students watching the older actors, how they are learning from them, and asking them questions and stuff is very, that keeps the art alive, mm-hmm. and is incredibly moving to me. So that feels really satisfying.
You're a collaborator.
That answered your question.
It absolutely did. Yeah. It did. Did you hear what I said?
Collaborator.
Yeah. Does it feel right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I think to be a director, you have to know a little bit about every aspect of a production.
And you have to
be able to step in and do that job if it's not happening the way you want it. So you're sort of a jack of all trades, but a master of none.
Well, but I don't think that's accurate. I mean, clearly you're a
master
of
many. But for me, the very best productions are when I have to do the least. Mm-hmm. So if the acting is happening and the design comes together beautifully and everybody's doing what they do, I could just stand back and love it. I mean, I'm exaggerating but I think it's true. It's true.
I think it is true. I think that you are a person who... It's really what you were saying at the beginning about sort of being a facilitator.
Yeah.
You know, maybe better than collaborator, facilitator is kind of what it feels like. Does that feel accurate or...?
It can be. Giving the space for something to happen. I believe that the best acting happens when an actor makes a discovery for themselves, mm-hmm. as opposed to me telling them what a moment is. Yeah. And so what I try to do is construct the right way to point towards a choice, and they get it themselves. So that a lot of directors can't do that.
I think that's accurate. I think a lot of directors either don't have the patience to wait.
Yes.
Or their ego is too much involved.
Yeah. Fear, I think, is the ego thing where they need to know that I'm in charge.
Yes.
They need to know that that I've made these choices and that I'm in control. And so I don't have that kind of personality, so I don't have to worry about it so much. I always love that actors appreciate having room to play and having room to make the discoveries themselves. And so they say, oh, he's so open. He gives us so much room. And then one of my best friends will come to the play and they'll say, that's you all over that stage. It's unbelievable. How did you do that? And so that balance is really funny to me because I managed to put myself all over the stage.
But that's your skill.
Yeah.
That is your skill, to communicate that somehow without seeming to be dictatorial.
Right. And right? I think that part of it, too, is understanding the way that actors work. They need a little room because sometimes for part of the time they're just figuring out where to stand and trying to get the lines out right, and then it takes them some time, and then through lots of experience I've learned that I have to wait till the right moment to give you the note, because if I give you the note too early you're just trying to move and stand in place and figure out the lines and stuff, and then the note might get incorporated in a bad way. If I wait till you're ready and I give you the note right when you're ready, it's easy.
Yes.
And so it's that kind of patience that I'm just lucky that I have.
Well, I think it's two things. I think it is absolutely true that this is a natural way of being for you, that you do have the patience to wait. But I also think it's a skill that some people never develop.
Well, when you understand how it works and you see the rewards of it, then it's easy to do it.
Yeah, I think so. I think some people never get it.
No.
I think some people never get it. But it's clear that you have gotten it, and I think this is a great place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you so much,
you.
Mark. I can't
really
wait to see the play.
Delightful to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
When I did that interview, as you can hear, I have not yet seen the play. But I did see it last night, and I can wholeheartedly say, run right out, get your tickets, because it's a delightful evening in the theater. It is hilarious. It's funny and charming, and it zips right by your, you know, you get to intermission and you think, my God, can it have been Act One? It's wonderful, charming, interesting, compelling. It's just, it's a delightful evening in the theater. And you get to see Mark Rucker's magic on stage. So by all means, run right out and get your tickets and come on down to the Oslo and see Once in a Lifetime. Well, I'm about to run out of time and space here. So I want to do, as I always do, I want to thank Josh Hackney, my IT guy who has done everything that there is to do related to sound, electronics, the putting on of this show. And as I say almost every week, he built me this computer and he taught me to use the things that I do not know how to use, and then he reteaches me when I forget, because I forget. And so if you have any issues with computers or electronic or recording, you want the kind and gentle Josh Hackney, and you can get him by going up on my website, thelynshow.com. thelynshow, where you can also hear the podcasts from the shows, all the shows that I have ever done. You can learn anything that you would like to learn about me. You can read my article on psychotherapy on the go, in case you are interested in doing therapy on the phone, which is what I currently do. If you are a social media person and you use Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn and you like the show, please go up on one of your favorite sites and tell other people about us. And if you are one of the 65,000 people who have listened to the show, as I said earlier, please email me and tell me who you are and where you are. Well, okay, so as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that you didn't know, which you now know. Something that interested you, surprised you, made you laugh. Something that will bring you back. Because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get.